and welcome to episode 32 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. Today is the 18th of July 2023. My name is Rebecca Thompson and I wrote the first investigation into the Post Office Horizon IT scandal for Computer Weekly back in 2009.
Hello, my name is Nick Wallace and I am the author of the book The Great Post Office Scandal.
Our guest today is David Enright, a lawyer from Howe & Co, who represents about 150 former sub-postmasters at the Post Office Horizon IT Inquiry. David has considerable experience of working on public inquiries and at the Post Office Inquiry, and he has been instrumental in making sure his clients are properly represented and their voices are heard. David, thanks a lot for joining us and welcome to the programme.
Well, thank you, and thank you very much for your kind introduction.
We've got so much to talk about over the course of the next hour, and I'm delighted that you've agreed to join us because you've probably got an opinion on lots of the issues that we want to touch on. We've got the Post Office's disclosure failings for the inquiry, the racist terminology that one of its documents used to describe sub-postmasters, which came to light recently. So Wynne Williams, the chair of the inquiry's health, his unfortunate bout of pneumonia, which meant that the inquiry had to be postponed for an entire month. Bonus gate, Nick Reed suddenly breaking cover and giving interviews left, right and centre, and the meetings that he's been having with sub-postmasters behind the scenes. And I also want to just get some insight from you on what it's like to work on an inquiry like this and your thoughts on when it might ever end. But if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to start with yesterday's interim report on compensation and the issue of compensation in general. So for new listeners, Sir Wynne Williams, the chair of the inquiry, had a report which he put before Parliament yesterday into which he, I don't know how you'd characterise it, David, it wasn't full of radical suggestions. It struck me as tidying up a few loose ends and making nice noises about the Horizon Compensation Advisory Board.
Beyond that, I don't agree at all.
Go on. Get in there.
I thought it was an exceptionally powerful report.
Ooh.
The starting point is, and this is probably be lost on a lot of people listening, is the chairman produced a video introduction for his report. And in that report, he said how deeply affected he had been by the accounts he had heard during phase one and two of the human impact of postmasters and of their suffering and hardship. And he said that the impact on him had not lessened one degree. And we had clients contacting us because we played this to our clients in a meeting we had yesterday with 92 sub-postmasters. And people emailed me saying that they had been in tears when they had seen that video because for them they felt that Sir Wynne genuinely got them and understood them.
And am I right in thinking that you had, we'll get back to the report in a moment, though, because just touching on that human impact hearings, am I right in thinking that you had a hand in ensuring that the inquiry pushed the voices of the sub-postmasters front and centre and actually had those proper human impact hearings so everyone knew exactly what these sub-postmasters had been through?
Well, yes, I and my colleagues have learnt over the past 20 years of doing public inquiries how vitally important it is that the victims are heard. People are so keen to move on and do the investigation without actually listening to the victims. So initially, we engaged with the inquiry and very much encouraged them in robust terms that they must hear from victims. And that was accepted. But the hearings initially appeared that they were only going to be fairly limited and in London. So we then argued that this was a truly national scandal and that the inquiry genuinely needed to reach out to other parts of the country. And I'm very pleased that the inquiry responded to that positively. And we had hearings in Belfast, in Glasgow, in Leeds, in Cardiff, as well as London. And you know, those were, as you've seen, tremendously powerful and have had an enormous impact on many of the witnesses attending and provide valuable
evidence. And the inquiry staff themselves, you can tell, as Sir Wynne Williams said in that video.
Yeah, the impact... Because people talk about SPMs and they talk about postmasters and postmistresses. What does that mean? But when you have a human being appearing on screen, often in tears, opening up their soul, and people see them and say, "But there, but for the grace of God, go I." That is someone who looks like me, sounds like me, and that could have happened to me. So it was enormously powerful, and Sir Wynne and his inquiry team are to be applauded for making that a full part of the inquiry process. So I really appreciate that.
how do you tend to find that inquiries unfold differently if they do that compared to if they don't do that, if you don't hear from victims?
Well, a good, really good example is, for example, the Grenfell Tower inquiry. It was originally proposed that there would be a kind of a memorialisation by Richard Millett QC, who was the lead counsel for the Grenfell Tower inquiry, where he would sort of stand up at the beginning of the inquiry and speak for maybe 2 hours and give an account of all of the victims. And myself and Martin Howe and other solicitors who were involved in the inquiry said, "No way, Jose, you are going to hear from the victims." And so you may then remember, and it's great credit to Sir Martin Moore-Brick that he responded to that.
He's the chair of the inquiry.
We had 2 weeks of the most compelling personal evidence from the survivors of the inquiry, talking about their last one, their last loved ones, etc., which really set the whole tone of the inquiry going forward. So that was a powerful example there and something we learned from. Because we must remember that but for victims, there would be no inquiry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so you brought that experience into the post office inquiry. Let's go back to this report then, because you think it is powerful. You think it is going to make a
tremendously
difference.
Tremendously powerful. I mean, the first thing we must appreciate that it is enormously unusual for a chairman of an inquiry to look at anything to do with compensation before the end. Because quite normally and naturally, an inquiry will want to find out what happened, who knew what and when, and who was responsible before ever approaching anything to do with compensation. And we and others pushed from the outset that there was a real burning urgency around this. And again, in fairness to Sir Wynne Williams and his team, they responded to that and highly unusually held compensation-focused hearings in July last year, December and April, and they're going to continue doing that. And each time they hold one of those compensation-focused hearings, as if by magic, the Post Office and Department of Business all of a sudden start doing things. So the best example, of course, is last July. We had the first compensation hearing scheduled for the 7th of July. And lo and behold, on the 30th of June, they announced a compensation scheme for the GLO victims with interim compensation, something that, you know, I think simply would not have happened but for the focus brought to bear on it by the inquiry and Sir Wynne Williams. And each time thereafter, Nick, when we've had these compensation hearings, you always get some positive development. So on the 8th of December, when we had the next compensation hearing, the day before, DBT published some of the details of the GLO compensation scheme.
That's DBT, Department for Business.
Department of Business, correct. So it's nothing focuses the mind like a hanging, and when these hearings are held, surprisingly, you know, the Post Office and Department of Business start acting.
But didn't Sir Wynne have an option here to say, right, this compensation has become such a mess, this patchwork quilt with holes in it has become such a mess that we need to hand it over to an independent authority led by a retired judge who can make final determinations on compensation rather than leaving it in the hands of the Post Office and the government? Didn't he dodge that bullet?
I think he dodged it. What he did was, in fact, we wrote to him precisely on this issue fairly recently, saying that we would encourage him to have a retired High Court judge have oversight of the schemes. And what he's done is he's effectively given the advisory board that role. And the, you know, key members of the advisory role, like Lord Arbuthnot and Professor Richard Moorhead, you know, they are people that generally are trusted by postmasters as people who, you know, will want to act fairly. And so he's effectively done that just by a slightly different means. Because if you were to say, I'll tell you what we'll do, let's pause the compensation schemes and let's find a retired High Court judge who can, you know, give up his time to do all this and then spend 6 months reading into it all, well, compensation is put on hold. And it can't be put on hold. And this is what Sir Wynne Williams is saying. The compensation is urgent. He's saying that if we had our time again, we would have one scheme, but we don't have our time again. We are where we are. So we must press on as hard and as fast as we can with what we have. And that's what he's done. And, you know, the most obvious example, I think, is the his call for legislation. Again, that's something we wrote to him about back in April when we discovered the funding mechanism that was being used to underpin the group litigation ex gratia scheme was the 1932 Concordat, which I had never heard of until then, which is it's an emergency way in which government can fund a project, but it must be time limited. And so we were able to write to Sir Wynne and say, this is why the deadline of the 7th of August 2024 is in place, because of this emergency type funding. There's general support across the House of Commons for this matter. It could easily be put on a statutory footing, and that is what he has done. So that means that nobody's going to be timed out of compensation. And we know that's a real problem, and Sir Wynne has highlighted it, because, for example, and I know we're going to get on to disclosure, that the Post Office said a couple of months ago it was going to take them 32 weeks to provide disclosure of documents to solicitors assisting people making compensation claims. That's an eight-month delay, which would take you right up, pretty much up to December this year. And leaving you only 8 months to complete 555 complex claims for compensation, which is an impossibility.
Well, let's get on to the issue of disclosure, because there are two particular issues here. One is the issue that you mentioned, when your individual clients are looking for disclosure from the Post Office about their case. And then there's the wider issue of disclosure made to the inquiry, which has been so inept, and one hopes it's only ineptitude rather than anything more sinister, that has thrown a spanner into the works of the entire inquiry. Perhaps you could explain for people, again, who may not be familiar with the ins and outs of this, what exactly has been going on, why we're currently becalmed.
Well, I suppose the first thing we need to do, Nick, is explain to people what disclosure is.
Good point.
And that is simply when you're dealing with a case like this, particularly involving a public body, they have all the evidence. And without that evidence, nobody can work out what's true and what's not true, or what's important and what's not important. And so when we talk about disclosure, we're really talking about the evidence that the inquiry needs. Now, this inquiry follows a line on the part of the... From the get-go, the Post Office has been appalling on disclosure. The chairman details this in his quite lengthy report of disclosure. He talks about the huge problems of disclosure during the group litigation, Bates and others. He talks about the huge problems of disclosure during the criminal appeals. He talks about the huge problems of disclosure in Crown Court cases, but also here in the inquiry. And let's not forget, the chairman had to adjourn hearings last year. If you look back to last April, the chair had to issue a statement saying he was adjourning hearings scheduled for June and July at that time because of huge volumes of late disclosure. So this is a road we have trod before.
This sort of most recent issue with disclosure came to light as a result of Eleanor Shake's FOI, which led to the disclosure to a member of the public, effectively, and as a member of the public, a campaigner, the disclosure of a document exposing the use of racist terms to describe sub-postmasters. This was late May, wasn't it?
Which the inquiry didn't have.
Which the inquiry was not given.
Eleanor Shake is another one of the heroes of this piece, who has been out there battling and digging and ferreting for information for years and exposing really important evidence. And once again, she has. And just touching on this racism issue, because it's very interesting. They had this basically a racially profiling document, racially profiling some postmasters. This was a document used by their fraud team and was used quite recently. It wasn't a historic document. And this came out during the evidence of the Post Office's General Counsel, Ben Fote, that it had been circulated something like 21 times up until, I believe, 2019.
I think it was certainly 2016, said Jason Beer. So... yeah, may have even been later than that, but yeah, this was not historic.
No, an astonishing document, describing people as kind of Chinese types and this kind of thing, Negroid types, appalling, Victorian type phraseology. What that was doing, we don't know, but what we do know from another Freedom of Information Act request is that. And you have to do some extrapolation, but effectively, 39% of those prosecuted were BAME.
As in ethnically diverse, non-white.
Yeah, black, Asian, minority, ethnic people. So 39% of postmasters prosecuted came from minority groupings, which is a big number. And if we look at the statistics, we look at the statistical information from the censuses of the time, and that number is, you know, out of all proportion with the general census. Now, there can be underlying reasons. It could be, for example, in the post office that there was a very high proportion of BAME postmasters. That could be the case. But we, using Eleanor's evidence and other research we've done, again, we've written to the chair about this and saying that on its face, there is a very serious issue relating to prosecutions of sub-postmasters where race may have impacted. And that we think that the inquiry does need to look at this as a discrete issue. And spend
And it is massively important in itself. But what it triggered was the realization that the inquiry had not been given this document. It had been given, am I right in saying, a similar document, but not the document containing this language. And it was only when Eleanor's Freedom of Information request grubbed it up that the inquiry realized there was a potentially serious problem with disclosure.
Yeah, and you could see how, I won't say angry, but exercise Jason Beer KC was in his questioning of Benjamin Foulkes, the Post Office's General Counsel, because it was not just this astonishing document, but also the fact that they were told the night before Mr. Foulkes gave evidence that there were somewhere in the region of 4,700 documents relating to Gareth Jenkins and others that had not yet been disclosed to the inquiry, and then in the coming days they let us know that there might be hundreds of thousands of other documents that haven't yet been disclosed to the inquiry. So we have this extraordinary thing where this has been going on for years. The post office has been through the disclosure process again and again and never seems to be able to get it right. And so when you look at the chairman's language in his statement in relation to disclosure and the directions he issued, it's exceptionally powerful language for a judge. In paragraph 13, he talks about the submissions made on behalf of core participants and our clients do share this, who genuinely believe that the post office are deliberately withholding evidence. That's their belief. And it's not a belief drawn from nowhere because they've had the experience of the civil litigation, of the criminal appeals, etc., and this inquiry process where there have been continual problems with disclosure. But the chairman says that he is determined to be as open-minded about this aspect of my investigation as I hope in relation to all other aspects, which is a very telling phrase from him, because a judge will naturally accept what a public body is saying unless there is strong evidence to the contrary. But his language in there is quite powerful. And he goes on at paragraph 19 of his statement to say, when I notified the parties of the need for a hearing on Tuesday the 11th of July in relation to disclosure, I described the current position as it related to disclosure as being grossly unsatisfactory. Having reflected on the use of that phrase, brackets, given that it was widely reported, close brackets, I stand by it. So Sir Wynne Williams has described this as being grossly unsatisfactory. And
is that as strong as a judge gets? Because, I mean, you speak to your clients all the time. You speak to ordinary people all the time. And the language is very different outside the inquiry. And
yeah, I just wonder.
They use other words. And, I mean, but to what extent, though, he's now put in place this Section 21 notice is going to be attached to every request for disclosure, which means that failure to disclose without a reasonable excuse could lead to criminal sanction. This is just a big stick, isn't it? Focusing the minds for a potential hanging.
Because as he concludes in his statement of paragraph 24, he highlights the fact that the maximum sentence of imprisonment is 51 weeks for failure to comply unreasonably with it. Now, he, via Mr. Steen KC, our leading counsel, we made submissions and the chairman effectively adopted those submissions, including in relation to the use of Section 21 and Section 35. The chairman has upped the ante. He said he is grossly unsatisfactory. He's now talking very openly about the potential need to use criminal sanctions, which is astonishing.
It is. I mean, it is a major step and was widely reported as so. But I just wonder what the post office response is going to be. Are we to picture now dozens of lawyers and post office staff frantically beavering away to make sure they don't mess this up? Or will this just be don't worry, lads, that's just another stage in this process?
Well, that's a very good point you're saying, something we've been mulling over. And I'm going to use another colloquialism that the post office up until now haven't really had skin in the game. Because, say, a financial sanction is imposed. Well, Nick, you pay that. Rebecca pays that. The people living in the pay that. So there's no skin in the game. And so what is it you need to do to give people some skin in the game and give them a little bit of jeopardy? And, you know, the threat of a referral to the High Court, possible, which could lead to a finding of contempt of court, and potential criminal sanctions will start to focus minds.
David, have you come across anything like this in the past, any other inquiry? Is this sort of thing new to you? And what are your kind of thoughts on it? Is it as extraordinary as it feels to someone with less experience?
It's becoming less odd, probably because you will remember recently the farrago over Boris Johnson's WhatsApp messages and the Cabinet Office fighting disclosure of those in the High Court. The High Court gave them short shrift. Sir Martin Moore-Bick, the chairman of the Grenfell Tower inquiry, had to apply to the High Court also to compel disclosure from one particular witness, and the High Court was very willing to do so. So what we can see is the High Court will support a chairman of an inquiry if he is being balked in his work in obtaining disclosure. So the fact that Sir Wynne's saying it means he's considering it, and it's very serious. And I would expect people at the post office to start thinking about that very seriously.
Yeah, well, as so many of your clients have learned, the proof of the pudding's in the eating. And there's very many fine words and off-stated benign intentions. But you've got to look at what actually happens on the ground before you can really conclude anything. I'd like to move this on if we could, because I'd love to get your thoughts on the annual report, which again was spotted by another campaigner, Tim McCormack. This is a falsehood that's found its way into the post office's most recent annual report, stating that it should get 100% of its bonus metric awarded to its top executives because of all the fantastic work it had been doing on the inquiry. And the reason it should get 100% is because it had been signed off by Sir Wynne Williams and the inquiry team, which was completely false. Now, there has obviously been one report into this. The government is looking at another element of this, the corporate governance, how this actually got into a document that is legally presented before Parliament. But when this broke in the middle of, I think it was phase three of this inquiry, and you guys were obviously had your heads down working on something completely different, what was your reaction?
You had to shake your head. You really thought, surely, what a schoolboy error. I think in relation to Nick Reed, it amounted to something like £13,000 of his 400 and something thousand pound bonus. And you would have thought anyone with any sense sort of would have looked at that one and, you know, and wondered whether you should take that part of your bonus. You know, how did it help? You know, because the post office has not entirely covered themselves in glory during the course of this inquiry. So giving yourself a bonus for assisting it is, you know, it's a bit of an own goal, to say the least.
That's the first stage of it. And I think Amanda Burton has managed to exonerate the post office, said that it was a legitimate thing to do to try to motivate people and focus their minds on the inquiries. That's a moot point.
No, I accept I would accept that. If you want to motivate people, you know, you've got to find ways of incentivizing things. And that can be through pay, can be through bonuses, can be through lots of different things. And if you genuinely want to support the inquiry, then, you know, there's a case. But the thing is, they didn't. And we know that because we now know that there are thousands upon thousands of documents the post office haven't provided that have caused nearly the whole of phase four to be adjourned. And the cost of the public purse to you, Nick, to Rebecca and to all of your listeners, once again, is borne by us, the public, because of a failure by the post office.
Is it not also a bit extraordinary that somebody needs incentivizing beyond the hundreds of thousands of pounds that are already being paid in order to right a historic wrong, even if you weren't personally involved in it?
You could go down that route. I can absolutely see that the people looking in would think, you know, come on, you know, this is unfair. Put it right. You're paid enough already. But, you know, we are where we are. You know, it is, the Post Office is a big organisation. And I can understand why people will want to motivate people to do the right thing. Well, not do the right thing, but to put extra effort in, put 100% effort in. Unfortunately, that just didn't happen. It just didn't happen. And the consequences are that we've lost weeks of evidence, and the inquiry has been delayed by at least a couple of months.
On top of that, we now have the prospect of a criminal investigation into the executives for not handing back all of their bonuses related to the inquiry. As you mentioned, Nick Reed only handed back 13,600, which is, I think, a quarter of the total amount he was given for his work on the inquiry, or that he received as a bonus for his work on the inquiry. And Darren Jones, the chairman of the Business Select Committee, has suggested he pay all of it back. At the moment, he's refusing. And this seems to have landed him in hot water because a complaint has gone to the Metropolitan Police. Now, David, think this is a sideshow, or do you think this is actually very important and is part of making sure that the Post Office understands the seriousness of what's going on as much as the sub-postmasters and the British public do?
I think it's a two-part question. First of all, you know, the optics don't look good. I mean, really, what are you thinking? But that's a matter for people to decide themselves. Whether there's been any criminality, well, the Metropolitan Police will determine that. The other element is that sometimes you have to educate your opponent. Sometimes your opponent needs to learn lessons, and we may get onto that when we start talking about restorative justice. But, you know, the Post Office is a bit like an oil tanker. It takes a while to turn around, like any big bureaucracy. And, you know, they've been heading in the wrong direction for a long time, and it takes a long time to turn it around. And, you know, we're all looking to Nick Reed, hopefully, to do that. And in fairness to him, Nick, I know that he's the first CEO of the Post Office who ever agreed to speak to you. And he has made himself
available. Took him a while.
It took
him more than 3 years.
Yeah, but he came out of the woodwork in the end made himself available. So, you know, let's reward good behaviour and punish bad behaviour. What is our alternative? You know, I heard there were calls for for Nick Reed and the whole board to resign recently. What is that going to achieve? Really, realistically, what's that going to achieve? All it will do is hold up the inquiry further, hold up compensation further, whilst a new chief executive and a new board, you know, read into what's been going on and find out what to do. So that's not necessarily going to help.
Further delays.
It just causes further delays. So what we need to do is, unless it becomes impossible, we need to work with the people we have. We need to carry a big stick, and also we need to encourage them to do the right thing by engaging with them and making sure they understand why it's important. And I had an interesting series of meetings recently with Nick Reed, where he travelled to Belfast to meet a significant group of postmasters in Belfast in person, and had very lengthy meetings, himself and Simon O'Caldon, who oversees the historic compensation schemes, very, very lengthy meetings with a significant number of Northern Irish postmistresses, who had the fullest opportunity to recount to him their experiences, what it had, the impact on their families, the impact on their reputations, the impact on their families' reputations, which is the most important thing for all of them in the rural Northern Irish context. Your family's reputation is paramount because it's generational. If you damage your family's reputation in this generation, in two generations from now, people won't do business with you.
Do you know what? That was first brought home to me when I was weirdly having dinner at Jesus College in Cambridge, and there was a professor from India sitting next to me, and we were talking about the Post Office scandal. And she said, and we were talking about the shame that many people from the Indian subcontinent felt when they were prosecuted or sacked, and how that sometimes their own families disowned them. And she said, it won't be just their immediate families. Back in India and Pakistan, their entire extended family would be shunned by their community. And then that would be a stigma that would be attached to them, as you say, generationally. And it really at that point brought home to me the scale of what the post office has done. Because if you think about the thousands of people directly involved, you could be talking about tens of thousands of people indirectly involved in some way.
Well, for example, during the course of those meetings, it was a very challenging series of meetings. Mr. Reid and Mr. McAllen repeatedly asked everyone who attended, did they know why people weren't coming forward? For example, convicted postmasters weren't coming forward to challenge their convictions. And after they'd asked that two or three times to different people, I turned to one of my clients and I was saying, I won't use her name, I'll call her Jane. I said, Jane, tell him. And she then went on to describe two postmistresses who live within 3 miles of her rural home, both of whom who suffered shortfalls and had to pay very large sums of money back, and who were still paying that money back now, would not come forward because for fear of shaming their families.
So, David, is this the process of restorative justice that you mentioned? This is that in action.
You'll probably remember because I know you read our written submissions very detailed way. But last December, one of the submissions we made was that, you know, yes, there must be proper, fair, full compensation. Yes, there must be truth recovery through the inquiry. You know, who knew what, where and when, who is responsible, who is accountable. But there's another element outside of all that, which is restorative justice. How do you try to give people back their self-respect, self-control, or sense of control of matters? How do you restore their reputations, etc.? And that kind of thing will operate in a restorative justice process. And so we made submissions calling on the post office to engage with a restorative justice process. And initially, they were very lukewarm, would be a kind thing to say about it, but they didn't buy into it. But we then had these meetings in Belfast and London with a whole series of posts. They were all postmistresses, actually. And they were enormously powerful. The individuals themselves found those meetings to be very positive, very useful, and they said so in writing. They felt they had been heard. They felt they'd had a full opportunity to express themselves. They'd been able to ask very direct and very pointed questions and to receive answers and to be treated with respect. Nick Reid told me on, I think it was the 26th of June, that after returning from Belfast and having met these women, that he called a meeting of his 100 top leadership in the post office to tell them about the meetings that he'd had and what he had heard from these people and the issues around, you know, bad culture within the post office, and it impressed upon them, you know, his desire to root out any bad culture. But also in the sort of margins of those meetings, we discussed again this restorative justice process. We said that the last thing they needed was lawyers. What they needed was a restorative justice expert to come and talk to them about it. Secondly, if they were on board with the restorative justice process, it's a who would pay for it? Well, there's three parties. There's post office, there's government, there's Fujitsu. Fujitsu's got a real reputation issue here as well. You know, they have a role to play in all. Perhaps they also need to chip in. And then they need to give up control of a restorative justice process to the victims. The abuser cannot control the process. You have to go to the victims and you need to say, what does restorative justice look like to you? And, you know, we made suggestions as to things that could be in that, such as, you know, bursaries to assist with the retraining of postmasters, you know, ongoing psychiatric and counselling support for postmasters and their family, a tangible memorialisation scheme, restitution and restoration of reputation in the local communities in which people lost their reputations, and a number of issues like that. But
so has anyone signed up to this then? Has anyone signed up to this yet?
Well, the feedback we got from the meetings from the post office is that they now could see the real value. They could really see it. They could understand it. Having met individuals, having heard from them, seen one-on-one, you know, 2 feet away from each other, the pain that people have experienced, I think that is something that may well now have legs. And I really hope so, because in the Grenfell Tower inquiry, we did manage to establish a restorative justice process. A very well-funded one, which sits outside of compensation. It sits outside of your truth recovery, and is a very, in our experience, is a very powerful way of giving back victims a part of what they've lost.
Because well, let us know if you get anything out of Fujitsu.
But if I just finally say on this thing, the key thing that victims want is for this thing to have never happened.
Yeah.
And I remember Christian Clement in Cardiff when he gave evidence to Sir Wynne. And Sir Wynne asked him then, is there anything else you want to say to me, Mr. Clement? He said, yes. Can you make it so that this never happened? And of course we can't. So in the absence of that, what can we do to restore your faith in yourself and give comfort to your family and to, you know, to restore the whole person? And that's what restorative justice.
Restoring self-respect in some ways as well. I guess slightly related to that, the reopening of settled compensation claims is another thing that's come up slightly recently. So both Nick Reed, the chief executive, and Kevin Hollenrake, the minister for postal affairs, they have said, I think to you, Nick?
Yeah, no, in the Radio 4 documentary we did, yeah.
Yeah, they've committed to reopening compensation settlements if the schemes are found to be unfair. What's your thoughts on that, David?
And I appreciate the word found is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence.
Well, obviously it's positive, you know, because one of the problems, for example, with the HSS scheme, the historical shortfall scheme, was initially it effectively didn't make any provision for legal advice. And then it had very, very limited legal advice. So you had many people apparently seriously undersettling claims because they have no idea what they're claiming for. They have no idea what they're entitled to claim for, how to evidence it, et cetera, et cetera. And some very stark examples of that were given to Sir Wynne during the compensation hearings. So it's right that they reopen those schemes to people who feel they've been undersettled. But the trouble is people have got lives and they want to get on with their lives and they can't keep going through process after process. And, you know, who wants to meet a lawyer? You know, not a lot of people. And, you know, because people have gas bills to pay and, you know, jobs to do, you know. And so this is the difficulty of it all, you know, that I think a lot of people have just had enough. They just had enough.
Yeah. But do you take the fundamental point that the way particularly the historical shortfall scheme, the largest scheme, was set up for people who hadn't been prosecuted or part of the group litigation was fundamentally unfair in that it didn't provide for legal advice for claimants, and therefore, and the wording of the application form, which was a legal claim form, framed out certain what lawyers would call heads of loss, which sub postmasters could have claimed for.
Yeah, and of course, if you had legal advice, a decent legal advice, your lawyer would be able to say, no, we can claim for this as well, even though they say you can't, we should. Let's put it forward, let's see what goes. We've got the evidence to support it. Or if we don't, we should assert it and argue for it, you know.
But I can't see that as being anything other than deliberate on the part of the post office lawyers who designed that form and that scheme.
Well, it's not for me to criticise professional colleagues. There's a real difficulty around this, and funnily enough, it's about lawyers. That a lawyer's job is to represent their client,
you know, and act in their best interest.
Best interest of their client. Now, if your client, the best interest of your client is not to pay anyone compensation, you know, then clearly your professional duty is to work in a way as to limit your client's liability. And this is part of a tension in all of this, you know. And it takes a very strong client or a strong organisation to say, no, you know, I understand you're trying to act in my best interest, but we want to fully and fairly compensate people. And what we want you to do is to go out there and find really creative, simple, easy methodologies to encourage people to come forward to get their full and proper compensation.
Mm. Well, I understand that tension, and it was highlighted by a number of people in their submissions to Sir Wynne Williams. But Sir Wynne rejected them in his interim report. He said, no, the stated intention from the post office and government is full and fair compensation, so I don't foresee any problems. And I thought,
what he said. If we're talking about his report from yesterday, he was saying a different thing. He was saying the government have repeatedly said that they want people to be fully and fairly compensated. I take them at their word, and I'm therefore proposing these measures to ensure that they do the thing they say they're going to do. So Sir Wynne is actually doing a reverse thing. He's taking what you've said in public and saying, right, that's what you said. I accept what you said. Therefore, you must do it.
Do you foresee this hitting the buffers somewhere down the line, or maybe not hitting the buffers, but coming up against a large number of people who want their claims revisited? And do you see a mechanism for that being able to happen within the parameters as now laid down by Sir Win?
How long is a piece of string? I think there's a lot of people out there who will have made claims to the HSS on their own, got some money, and then just thought, right, I'm going to move on with my life now. You know, they don't know about reopening claims, etc., etc. You know, well, how would they find out?
But if I felt that if I didn't claim for punitive damages against the post office for what had happened to me, and I now realised that I could, and I was angry about that, yeah. Do you think there is a mechanism for me being able to go back?
Yeah, it's called that exists. It's called asking. It's called asking. Right. And people often forget this. This is a very funny thing you can do, and that is you go to someone, you go to an organisation, you go to a chairman of an inquiry, you say, we think you should do this. These are the reasons why we think you should do it. Please do it. And it's surprising how often people will do the thing that you ask them to do if you just ask them directly.
Yeah, but you remember how long the government was saying the GLO deal was full and final?
Yeah, they were, but then we badgered them. I wrote to Boris Johnson about this in February 21. I wrote to Nick Reid about it on the 21st of October 21. If you look at my letter, which is on the public the Inquiry website, when I wrote to Nick Reid on the 21st of October, it pretty much sketched out the GLO scheme. That's pretty much what happened. You just ask and you keep asking, and as long as you have a reasonable basis for asking, it's surprising what people will do.
Okay, well, if I just put out a call, a request for anyone who's listening to this, thinking about getting their compensation settlement revisited in the light of what you've been hearing in the last few weeks, then I would be very interested in hearing from you, because I'd like to follow it through to see if it gets anywhere.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Nick. And, you know, there are good lawyers out there who can assist people. Obviously, Howe & Co., but there are others. There are Hodges, Hans Jones and Allen. There are all sorts of lawyers out there who are doing these types of claims, and they don't have to pay. Their legal fees are covered by the schemes, so that there's no cost to the individual. So there's no harm in asking.
Can we now talk about a Carl Flinders story from Computer Weekly, recently published? He talked to Lord Arbuthnot, who was calling for the post office, or for every prosecution by the post office during the Horizon era, to be revisited. He said that pretty much none of their prosecutions are safe unless there is the clearest of evidence that the person convicted has committed a crime. Did you see that story, and did you have any thoughts on it at all, David?
Well, yes, because I actually wrote to the chairman about, or I wrote to Nick Reid about this on the 2nd of May, precisely this, because at the hearing on the 27th of April, the post office's leading counsel, Kate Gallivant, told the inquiry that they were undertaking an in-house process using King's Counsel and junior barristers to review cases that may be suitable for future criminal appeal. But we wrote to them saying, well, that's good. But I'm sorry, you can't do that behind closed doors. You have to involve the individuals involved. They must be able to have a feed into that process, because, you know, you can't have the prosecutor once again deciding who gets an appeal and who doesn't. Because, for example, as you well know, Nick, many people pleaded guilty on the basis that, you know, they were advised it's the post office, they've got computer evidence, there's nothing you can do, roll over. And people pleaded guilty. So that meant that they did not go to court and did not produce exculpatory evidence that would demonstrate that they were innocent. So there's an absence of evidence there. So we've written to post office about that, saying you can't have a closed shop process. It has to be an open process where the potential victim has an opportunity to feed into what you're thinking. And so that we pushed that forward. And in fact, I'd provided a copy of that letter and the post office's response to Lord Arbuthnot for him to look at. Because there's a massive problem here. Only 10% of those wrongly convicted have come forward to have their convictions quashed. And let's not forget that if you had been convicted, if you started tomorrow morning and the sun was shining and the wind was at your back, it would take 2 years for you to clear your name. And, you know, people can't face it.
There's a bigger problem here as well, which I think Lord Arbuthnot may have also been referring to, and that's people who the post office has already discounted as being Horizon cases, because we know that they prosecuted 950 people during the period when Horizon was live and before they decided to stop being a prosecuting authority. And yet they initially decided that it was 736 odd that were Horizon cases. That number now stands at 700. We've also had a number of failed appeals. In fact, every single contested appeal has failed. And so I think Lord Arbuthnot is also talking about going back to the cases of Wendy Cousins and I think as Benjamin Fell, whose appeals failed. Is there any mileage in that whatsoever? Because my feeling is that the Court of Appeal would be extremely reluctant to consider that.
Well, I think this is the problem, Nick. Trying to get 700 appeals through the Court of Appeal, can you imagine how long that would take? Could you imagine how complicated? Because first of all, you've got to go to the Criminal Cases Review Board to get a referral, and only then can you go to the Court of Appeal. It's a very long and difficult process. And where do you get the evidence from 15, 20 years ago? How do you do that? It's impossible. Underlying it all is a computer system that we now know was deeply flawed from its inception and throughout. And there is increasing evidence that was known of from the outset and throughout. And though that system was the thing that underpinned practically all of these prosecutions. And if it was flawed, then there really is a case for trying to find a mechanism to quash those appeals. And that's something that I'm taking forward in private meetings at the moment to see what can be done about it. What creative thoughts can be brought to bear on this. That's not going to take 6 years.
Yeah. But do you share the view that the Court of Appeal has taken a too narrow definition of what a Horizon case is?
That's a hard question. I never like to criticise courts because they see a lot that we don't see. When you get reports of proceedings in courts, people always give you the headlines. They don't give you the full facts that were heard before a particular judge or other, These are very important things. Quashing an appeal is a very major step to take. And a court will never take that step.
Quashing a conviction.
Yes, it will never take a step like that lightly, because otherwise it genuinely would undermine our entire faith in the rule of law. If any conviction could just be set aside willy-nilly. So it's a very difficult process. And we need to be more creative about this, I think, in about how to address this. And we need to be prepared to accept that one solution might be to allow a small minority of postmasters who may have been involved in criminality, that they also have their convictions quashed one way or other, so that the overwhelming majority of those who were innocent can more quickly have their convictions quashed.
What would you say happens next? Well, obviously the hearings are due to start again on 26th of July, but there's all sorts of obviously ongoing issues which may cause further problems. What do you expect to happen in the sort of coming weeks and months?
Well, we know that the chairman and his inquiry team are very exercised and very vexed about this disclosure issue. And the chairman, interestingly, has said he's now going to, just like compensation, going to be holding regular disclosure review hearings. So he's going to drive that forward. I think the next phases are going to be very bad for Post Office, where we will really start to see some shocking evidence in relation to individual cases of the way people were treated. And all that will naturally feed into Sir Wynne's findings and conclusions, but it will also potentially have an impact on compensation. So that's what I expect to happen. It's not going to be a quick process. I'm sure that this inquiry will roll through into next year. And I think that's a good thing. Because so long as the inquiry is continuing, the focus on compensation will not be lost. As soon as the inquiry upsticks and ceases its work, I have a very real concern that the focus may go off compensation.
We've also had the issue with Sir Wynne Williams having to postpone the entirety of June's hearings due to a bout of pneumonia. And watching the video that he released yesterday, he's clearly not 100% again. I mean, if you contrast it to the last video he made in September last year, he looks unwell. I don't know whether you've ever had the experience of a chair being too unwell to continue an inquiry. A, is that a concern of yours? And B, what would you expect the inquiry to have in place as a plan B if Sir Wynne becomes too ill to continue?
Well, first of all, Sir Wynne Williams, certainly in his youth, was a very able rugby player and a very fit man and a robust man. And I'm not a doctor, but I'm sure he'll be able to continue. I would want him to continue because he is an excellent judge. He had a very high reputation as a high court judge previously. He is forensic. He's really over his brief entirely, and he has a firm grip on this inquiry. So I think all of us would want him to continue. And I, to be honest with you, I don't want to speculate in any way jinx a Welshman like my father by wishing ill health upon him.
Oh, no. And obviously we do wish him a full recovery, but one has to sort of hope for the best and prepare for the worst. And I mean, this inquiry has gone on a long time. When would you expect it to report? I've got 2025 in my head now.
I know. I think it can report before then. I think and it's just a wild guess. I would put it in the summer of 20, well, autumn 24.
Oh, okay.
I think we can get there then. And I hope and expect that Sir Wynne Williams will be at the helm throughout.
Do you think the post office will be able to sort itself out when it comes to disclosure? I mean, it's only another week or so to go. Do you think they'll be on top of it by then?
I think we'll get there. I think the focus is on them now. Our team and other teams are not taking our eyes off it at all. The inquiry are firmly focused on it. I think now that Sir Wynne is waving the stick of criminal action that the action will happen. It will become a priority for the post office and they'll get it done. That's my real hope and expectation.
Well, David, thank you very much indeed for your time on this podcast. We do appreciate your experience and expertise and your insight into... Actually, that is one question I do want to ask just before we go. What's it actually like working on this inquiry? I know you're in the middle of a very skilled team and you're dealing with an awful lot of queries from your clients and from the inquiry itself. What's it actually like being at the coalface?
It's a mixture of huge privilege and extremely hard work. As a lawyer, you don't always get to choose your clients. This is one of those wonderful cases where you represent the white hats and the other guys are the black hats. You're on the side of the angels. So it's a real pleasure. The type of people are also very interesting. They're all people who are real go-getters in their lives, people who've done things with their lives, created employment for others. They're very they're articulate, they're intelligent. They're switched on when we have very regular meetings once a week, once every 2 weeks, where we have 70 to 90 of our clients turn up for every single meeting. And they're so switched on and so engaged. So they're a real pleasure to work with and work for.
David, thank you once more for your time. We really do appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you, Nick.
Investigating the Post Office Scandal is produced and presented by Rebecca Thompson and Nick Wallace with advice and support from Whistledown Productions.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.